My name is Mark J. Lindquist from Ortonville, Minnesota, United States Air Force veteran.
Well, I appreciate your time and your service, but you also were a Fargo, North Dakota resident, and you've also been out to Bismarck and sang the national anthem in front of thousands of people there, and out at Grand Forks at the University of North Dakota Fighting Hawks, Fighting Sioux games, as well as many NFL stadiums. So let's, nice of you to give Ortonville a little plug there, but
yeah, the old hometown, you know, I love those folks back then.
How long have you lived in North Dakota, by the way? And, you know, say Fargo, Moorhead, and all the different North Dakota areas.
Probably half my adult life.
That's what
I
thought.
I came up there in 1999 for Concordia College to do some singing and some music. And, you know, as I've moved about the country and world, I always keep coming back home, and that's Fargo and Moorhead.
So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing over in the Ukraine. Last we talked, you were going to start running for a political office, but then you all of a sudden got the call.
Well, I tell you, I think the political office is part of just a lifetime of service. You know, always wanted to be of greatest service where I am and what I'm doing. And the war kicks off on February 24th, where Russia illegally invades Ukraine and, you know, raining down missiles and bombs on civilian infrastructure, apartment homes, supermarkets, and gas stations. And we all saw that on the news, just like I did back in February and March. And appalled, I hope, when you see things like that on your TV screen and your news feed. And I said, you know, I don't know, I'm a person of action. And I just felt compelled to come over here to Ukraine, where I've now been for about 138 days on a humanitarian mission over here, delivering supplies, medical supplies, food, and humanitarian aid to soldiers and civilians alike. And, you know, it really has been exactly what it should be, is when you decide to go help people who are in need. And been proud to serve over here for the last 138 days.
What's interesting to me, and we'll talk a little bit more about what you're doing over there and some of the happenings, but what's interesting to me is the media in this whole thing, because before we got on this interview, we were joking about, wow, you're over in the Ukraine, I'm over here in America, and we're just talking clear as a bell, just on this, you know, this handheld computer that's known as a communication device. It also calculates my tips for me when I go to restaurants. I haven't figured anything else out with this smartphone yet, but at least it does those two things. But in all seriousness, you know, when we look at a lot of the different wars of my lifetime, I'll just go back to George Bush Sr., where we got a lot of that through just a handful of channels, maybe CNN was around at that time, and that was kind of their, you know, kind of their homecoming party or their coming out party. Then came the 9/11, and that was 24-hour news networks, 24 hours a day, plus our traditional three or four news networks. Now, every single war, you got social media, and you've got 15 different kinds of social media. You've got hidden social media sites I've never heard of. Plus, you've got the traditional news. Plus, you've got 24-hour news. You've got all kinds of fragmented and segmented demographics out there. What are you seeing out there in the world of media? Is it, you know, is it the same that we're seeing here? Has it helped? Has it made it worse? Just talk to me a little bit about just your experiences with that.
I'll say this, out here in Ukraine, we call this the first Instagram war. You know, you think about those early days, as you referred to, where CNN was embedded with a tank battalion rolling up on Baghdad. And we were all just at the edge of our seats like, oh my goodness, this footage that used to be, you know, we would be wowed at a smart bomb landing on target. You know, and replaying that image in our head that we've seen a billion times. Then we were enamored by the embedded reporter. Now you have a military that allows their soldiers to have a GoPro on their shoulder or helmet. Now you have soldiers from foreign countries that strap their cell phone to their body armor. And you're getting video, you're getting footage in this first Instagram war of the modern era, like you've never gotten war footage before. And so the one thing that I would caution people to understand what's happening when now we have this front row seat to warfare is that do not be fooled by what's happening in your brain. Because how does the brainstem work? You need stimulation, then you need a greater stimulation to keep your attention. And aren't we seeing a lack of attention span in the world today? Understand that when you see a bombed out building in the cities that I live in Ukraine, and then you need to see a bombed out building that was even more, there was more destruction on the image in order to get you to stop scrolling on your newsfeed, you are now desensitizing yourself to the terrors of war. And I think it would be easy for people, if they didn't understand that that was going on in their own brain, desensitization to terrorism, it would be easy for us to forget what's happening over in cities like Kharkiv, Ukraine, 12 miles away from the Russians, where I live.
You mentioned the military's got cameras, much like I would imagine the police have got cameras on them, to where it's almost standard in a lot of cases. Is any of this in real time, or is this just, you know, vetted, or how does that work, I guess, if you guys are going in there with GoPro cameras and body cameras, right, and all kinds of stuff? I mean, is there a live site I can watch this, or what?
I mean, there's every Telegram channel, every Instagram live. It all depends on the decision-making ability and OPSEC procedures of the individual soldier. But remember, I think we take for granted the fact that we spend almost $1 trillion a year on defense, and thus we have the luxury of having things like an Office of Public Affairs on the base. We have things like a public affairs chain of command, where in the United States military, you wouldn't be able to talk to the press or post certain things on social media unless you cleared it by the base command. Out here, since they only spend $6 billion a year before this war on defense, they don't have such an infrastructure. And so there is no checks and balances. It's a dude named Vlad out there on the front line with his Instagram, YouTube, Facebook live, and nobody can stop him. It's fascinating to see an army fight against Russia, the second largest military power on earth, and be able to broadcast moment to moment live movements and frontline action from your smartphone. It's the first Instagram war, and it's fascinating what we're seeing.
I don't mean to stick on the social media side of things, but the fact that you called it the Instagram war, I do want to go back to that, because I was always told that, you know, the pipeline, Nord Stream pipeline and all these different things was the main root cause. And, you know, we can get into that in just a second. But if you're telling me that the colloquial, or the kind of the, I'm trying to think, the marketing word, if you will, internally is the Instagram war. Is that pretty well known, or is that just your troops? Or talk to me a little bit more about that term, where that came from, because that is remarkable.
I think it's just a commonly known and shared moniker out here.
Okay.
And folks just, I think they're as fascinated as anybody else to be able to open up their Telegram and Instagram and see their buddies, their uncles, their cousins, their neighbors out on the front line, and basically within a moment's notice, know where the bomb dropped, know what happened in that certain trench or frontline battle. Now, you hopefully have an individual who is operational security minded enough not to broadcast location of, troop movements.
Geraldo Rivera. Geraldo Rivera. Just kidding. Remember when he did that on Fox News? Oh, he started putting out the battle plans.
and that is definitely something that the Russian intelligence is watching. I don't know to which, to what effectiveness or depth. But people are certainly scouring social media channels.
This was my next question. My next question, when it comes to the world of social media, obviously, you know, being in the Fargo-Moorhead area, the Bismarck area, the Minot area, anywhere that floods, we've seen firsthand how social media can really help. Okay, this people need sandbags. This levee looks like it might break. Because it rallies the troops, saying? How was that going? Okay, talk to me a little bit about that, because I could see where you got a Geraldo Rivera out there actually drawing in the sand the battle plans, and then Russia, with their intelligence, who knows what kind of algorithms they have working on the backside to find out, you know, if they can glean any sort of advantage off of the social media aspect of this war. So talk to me a little bit about how that the security internally plays in, but also how about the just the people who are watching things? Is that helping, hurting? Is it just kind of nobody cares? Or you know what I mean? Because a lot of times the people who are the innocent bystanders, they can play a role too.
I'll pick up on that last point you made. Yeah. And it's miraculous out here in Ukraine how much further this society is technologically in the use of the technology for, well, useful purposes.
Really?
Every Ukrainian citizen has an app that you can open up on your phone. That's where you pay taxes. That's where your passport and your driver's license is electronically stored. There's a QR code that appears and disappears every 3 minutes so that those things can't be forged. And on that app, they can also notify the Ministry of Defense, their version of the Pentagon, of troop movements that you suspect or see. You can notify the Ministry of Defense about where you think the enemy is. And citizens are empowered with that on an app on their phone. And so it's fascinating to see the convergence of the civilian society engaged in warfare, much like I would have suspected that, you know, during the Revolutionary War times, people would notify military officials about suspected saboteurs, you know, the British inside their community. And so when in the places where I live that are 10 and 12 and 15 miles away from the Russian enemy line, certainly there are individuals in a community of 1.4 million people that are Russian sympathizers. And so the government of Ukraine has empowered its citizens to be on the lookout for that. It's like one great big neighborhood watch, and 38 million people that are left in the country are engaging in that. It's a fascinating thing to see, and for citizens to be so proud of that, to be able to tip off their military, their brother, their cousin, their commander that they know from their neighborhood, to be able to contribute to that war effort. It's inspiring.
Internally with your either your squad or the troops that are over there, is the information more or less accurate? Because, you know, I guess, you know, if you give faulty information, the government's going to come down and prosecute you. But sometimes people might not know.
And I think for the most part, what I've seen person to person is well-intentioned people trying to do what they can for the war effort.
Yeah.
And I have no idea the veracity of some people's claims. I have no idea if they are vetted at higher levels. I would certainly hope that individuals who are in charge of sifting through those messages have some sort of intelligence background, military intelligence background, to be able to know which leads to follow up on. But if nothing else, it is a lesson for the world in how these battles, especially if you're being invaded, can also be won, and you can have an advantage based on the citizen intelligence. And so also you have to be careful that everybody then, when empowered with that tool, wants to be a hero. And so maybe it is only 1 in 100 leads that are legit and actionable. But this idea that we can use our smartphones with Telegram channels that communicate. I'm involved in one Telegram channel which updates from Kharkiv and what happens in Kharkiv on a moment-to-moment basis. You can hear an explosion in Kharkiv, and on your Telegram within a few minutes, there are pictures that are non-identifiable as far as location about where that was, you know, what happened when that explosion went off. So, it's fascinating to see that.
So Instagram is a very popular site that was created by Facebook. I'm sorry, owned by Facebook. I don't know if they created or bought it, but they own, Facebook owns it, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I think they were independent, then Facebook
acquired. Yeah. And then the other one you keep mentioning is Telegraph. I'm not familiar with Telegraph. I've heard of it. I do not have a Telegraph account. What is Telegraph?
Yeah, it's Telegram. Telegram.
Oh, I'm sorry, Telegram. So, just to let you know how much I use it.
It's a messaging app. If you've heard of WhatsApp or you're familiar with Facebook Messenger, it's just a different way to communicate that has a higher level of encryption, when you communicate back and forth. But the user experience is no different than texting somebody.
Okay.
And so it's a third-party application that everybody seems to have gravitated towards. And certainly since the war in Ukraine began on February 24th, citizens have looked to Telegram because of its encryption for information. And so it's a place where humanitarian organizations will post information about needs or supplies available. It's a place where humanitarian organizations communicate with our little individually identified connections and organizations. And so without these tools at our disposal, and Uber and Bolt and Lyft and all these transportation applications, and for the Westerners to be able to book hotels on booking.com. I mean, these are things that I don't think I would have been able to do as a humanitarian volunteer if I went to Iraq or Afghanistan. So the fact that Ukraine is a high-speed Wi-Fi country, the fact that you can go to any hotel and navigate the city in an Uber, much like you would in any other European city, it gives some unique perspective on what happens in a war zone that is as advanced as Ukraine. Because when I walk down the city streets of these cities, maybe not the villages, but the cities, it really, Jason, it doesn't feel any different than me walking down the streets of Paris or Rome or Berlin or Munich or these places in Europe. I think we've been conditioned by 20 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan to think that the country that warfare happens in is technologically behind. But out here, in many ways, Ukraine is ahead of us.
That's interesting. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about some energy-related tidbits I've been told, or facts, or rumors, or just whatever. Of course, Mark Lindquist was the voice of the national anthem at the Bakken Barbecue in its third or fourth year, as well as the North Dakota Petroleum Council's annual meeting. And then I believe you did at the Petroleum Council, or the Williston Basin Council as well, the big conference.
Yes, sir.
So
I do believe
Mark J. Lindquist is very familiar with the oil and gas industry as well as the Bakken, and they are familiar with him as well. So when I started seeing that, you know, this pipeline is the cause, that the control over it, the environmental impacts behind it, it just seemed like that pipeline kept getting blamed for everything. Is there any truth behind that? What are you guys hearing out there? What's going on in the world of, you know, that energy and in relation with the war? Because I'm kind of told that one thing has to do with the other.
You know, a lot of people out here don't talk about that. Is it the Nord Stream pipeline, I think it's called?
Yes, yes.
And I believe, and tell me if I'm inaccurate here, a lot of that hoo-ha is because of where that gas comes from.
Correct.
Right? That, you know, being Russia. And so I don't hear anybody locally talk about that as far as the origins of the war. I think maybe that is more of a Western perspective. But I tell you one thing, one of my perspectives on pipelines, in fact, a lot of perspectives of mine have changed having been out in this war zone. But I don't know if it was published in the American media to great degree, but in the months of March and April and May, out here, the gas stations, the lines for fuel, were like the 1970s in America. I counted once there were 90 cars in line because they were rationing fuel at 10 liters. 10 liters, that's 2.5 gallons, is all you could get at a time in some cities in Ukraine. Now, pipelines, as it relates to your question, there are no pipelines in Ukraine. And so they had to truck it in from the Polish border. Or to my knowledge, there aren't pipelines like we think of them or think of the Nord Stream. And so you had to truck it in 18 wheels at a time. And so there was a gas shortage in eastern Ukraine where the humanitarian volunteers couldn't get fuel for their vehicles to deliver aid to the troops and the displaced people. And so, you know, these pipelines that we argue about back home, I tell you, when I put boots on the ground back in American soil, I will be the biggest advocate for having such a backup plan to transport fuel and oil and gas across the country without having to truck it in from, as we did in Poland these last few months.
I know exactly what you're talking about. One of the same things happened to me when I started the crude life. I had a certain perception of one thing and the reality became different.
Totally.
And pipelines, not only do they make more sense in so many different ways? I get that when they have issues, there's issues. But guess what? Every single thing has issues. I mean, just that's part of what's going on. I mean, I used to always joke that the agriculture industry was like the most dangerous industry for a long time that we could never talk about in the media because you had to, you know, feed the world type thing. You can't, you know, there's certain things where you got to be a grown up and just understand that, you know, life happens. So the pipeline part, I'm a big advocate as well, especially taking the trucks off the road. And boy, you're experiencing the time portion of the pipeline firsthand, huh?
And that really, out here in a war zone, time is life.
Yes.
Time is another life saved with the tourniquets that I have in the back of my car or the Israeli bandages that will save someone's life. And so it was so frustrating based on the decisions to build those or the infrastructure capability to put pipelines down in Ukraine that we couldn't deliver our simple box of humanitarian aid. And so it got real for us for the first moment. Maybe never before in my life had an oil or gas pipeline become something that interfered with my life or really made any difference whatsoever until I got to Ukraine, trying to get out to the Donbas, trying to deliver aid to guys that are using shoelaces as a tourniquet when they should be using a cap tourniquet. And so, you know, when you go to these places and you try to help, and you go to a foreign country where you don't speak the language and you're unfamiliar with their traditions, if you allow yourself to be open to some of these experiences, you can learn a lot. And I certainly have.
I wanted to ask you about Mark J. Lindquist on the line with us. He's over in the Ukraine right now. Are you with the National Guard brought over there? Are you with the Army, I guess? What branch of the military are you over there with?
I am unaffiliated with any official capacity tied to the United States of America. I'm an American citizen who used the freedom that's available to me, my American passport, and I walked across the Polish border into Ukraine.
Oh, I did not know that.
Operating. Yeah, I'm just a volunteer. I'm just an unpaid humanitarian volunteer on my own dime out here trying to do as much good as we possibly can. And there is no official capacity other than the fact that I'm an American citizen.
And, oh, no kidding.
Humanitarian volunteer.
Are you still involved with the military?
No, not at all.
Okay.
When I wear my Air Force uniform, the Air Force instruction allows somebody with wartime service and honorably discharged to wear that uniform for the NFL games. And so really it's just, you know, likened to your local VFW or American Legion where your guys get together and wear their camo, you know, to feel normal again.
So, you're just doing the humanitarian thing. Okay. Great. Okay. So what I wanted to ask you is about, what are they talking about there? You know, we're told the war is because of one reason. I told you kind of my geopolitical, if you boil it down, type of a reason that I've been told by a lot of different people. Whether it's true or not, don't know. I know that energy controls a lot of what we do and a lot of decisions are made upon energy. Now, what are the locals saying? What is the, you know, what's the vibe in terms of why did Russia invade?
I think Ukrainians know, if I know their perspective, they've known that the big bad wolf lives next door for their entire life. And that's Russia. And that's whoever is in control of Russia at the time. And so they are a culture of war. They are a culture of warriors who are always ready for an entity like Russia to invade or try to decimate them. And so it is no surprise to them. And remember, their war in the Donbas inside Ukraine has been going on since 2014, a little known fact to most Americans prior to this latest invasion. And so they understand that Ukraine has been a popular place to control for centuries. I don't think a lot of Americans know that Ukraine's constitution is older than ours. And so the traditions of freedom and the ideas that freedom should reign in a person's life are near and dear to the Ukrainians' heart. And they know that there are dictators and tyrannical ones at that who wish to control the world's most fertile land. We all know Ukraine is the fifth largest wheat producer on earth. And so, of course, Russia wants to control the ports. Of course, Russia wants to control that rich natural resource. And so I would say to your listeners, if you have forgotten about the people of Ukraine or have a certain political stance on Ukraine versus Russia, I would encourage you just to remember that there are farmers driving John Deere's in the Donbass, just like you. There are farmers out there that a friend of mine talked to one just the other day, 3,000 of their acres of wheat are untillable or unharvestable this year because there are landmines, Jason, on 3,000 acres of this farmer's land outside of Kharkiv, and they can't harvest it for fear of dying by landmine. The Russians are lighting fires in the wheat fields on purpose to starve the country. And I would remind you that that is a farmer. That's a farmer who goes through the same stresses as you do, and on top of that now has to deal with the stresses of war. So these are the people that we meet.
And just to bring it home, those acres are going to impact us here because with the Canadian issues up there that they have now and with their politics and then over in Ukraine, if these are actually happening, like you say, we are going to probably have food shortages. You know, when we start looking at next year or even, you know, end of this year, a lot of those crops that are being destroyed and are not being planted for political reasons or being destroyed because of COVID, whatever you want to call it, that's going to impact us. Then who knows, maybe we can only get 2.5 pounds of rice a month instead of 2.5 liters of gas a week or whatever you were talking about there. And that's real stuff.
The fact that it happens 5,000 miles away, I think anybody with a brain understands today that the world is more interconnected than it ever has been.
Oh, there was
absolutely is going to affect you.
Yeah, there was a great study done in Washington State, and I can't remember who it was, but it was shortly after NAFTA, and they took two apples, and they determined that the one apple that went to China and back was cheaper in Washington State than the one that was like 30 miles away. You know, because of the whole supply chain and the way that they had things going. The orchard that had apples like 40 miles, 30 miles from the Albertsons, or I forget who's out in Safeway.
Yeah.
Safeway out in Seattle. The one that went to China and back was cheaper. I just thought, oh boy, this is going to be a tough competition out there. Yeah, well, that's how she goes, you know, and when you control distribution, you really control a lot of things. You know, just take a look at, products. I know the Sunglasses Hut was famous for this, where they got into a beef with Oakley, and because they own, you know, Lens Crafters, and they own Sears Crafters, they own like 15 of the different distribution outlets for sunglasses, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oakley and them got into a fight. They stopped carrying Oakley. Oakley had to actually sell to them in order to stay alive. And so it's just a kind of, distribution means a lot. So that's why we're talking pipeline. That's why we're talking about the different social media aspects, because that is a form of distribution too. You know, the one thing that I will mention, getting back to social media, because that has become such an integral part of this war, to where they're actually calling it the Instagram war in the Ukraine, is that in North Dakota, we saw it work during floods extremely well. When I was executive producer at KFGO, I actually helped set up the City of Fargo and First Link's social media page with Kevin Tabosa. And one thing that we saw during that time was on social media, and remember, this was 10 years ago, we were the only place that listed a specific address on Lilac Lane in North Fargo. Over 70 people showed up to help sandbag. That's when we saw the power of social media, because we didn't broadcast it on the news. We forgot to email it to all the other stations, but because we put it on social media one time, 70 people showed up. Now that is during a natural disaster. The flip side is the war, because during a natural disaster and war, you have people engaged and watching and all kinds of different things. So we tell, you know, businesses, like, people are watching, you know, if you ever have a need for a natural disaster, maybe 70 people will show up and buy your sale item. But just because you have a sale item, don't expect everybody to show up. You know, you have to have kind of a cause and an action. So what are you asking people from social media out there? Are you asking people to share in America, comment? I guess what kind of solution or help can we give instead of just watching and liking and sharing?
First of all, I'm asking people not to forget and not to move on to the next thing, because we've seen that happen with Afghanistan. 6 weeks, we could look at the news and it was nothing but Afghanistan, Afghanistan, Afghanistan. And then all of a sudden we were on to Dave Chappelle and Britney Spears' conservatorship. We can feel that going on with the war in Ukraine. If this were a world event, as witnessed by Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation, our grandparents, I think in many ways they would scold us, because this is or is the brink of World War III. It is a sovereign nation where freedom once reigned. We call Ukraine the front lines of freedom. We call Kyiv the capital of freedom out here. And I think the first thing we can do is not forget. Secondarily, my mission personally is to move medical supplies. I've got a great deal with a great company called C.H. Robinson, a logistics company out of Minneapolis at Eden Prairie. And they've given me unbelievable deals on shipping containers of medical supplies. And our latest shipment is going to be $3.36 million worth of medical supplies to come on over to Ukraine. And it only is costing us a few thousand dollars to get that over across the ocean into the hands of hospitals who are now running dry because supply chains are locked up, because the Western donations are running out, because now local civilian hospitals are taking 200 and 300% of the patient load because of the displaced people, the refugees, and also the frontline injuries. And so I would just ask you to share that you know a guy that you've seen at your conferences, that you've seen speak at the high school in Ray in Tioga, and been out to Beach, North Dakota. And he's over in Ukraine and he's moving medical supplies. And all it takes is $250 per pallet to get me $42,000 US hospital grade donated medical supply from a warehouse in America. $250 gets me a whole pallet. And somewhere in the neighborhood of $4,500, we'll get it all the way to the Donbass. And that's a North Dakota, Minnesota guy that is doing that. And you can get in touch with us through this station.
Okay, so we are going to have all the links available at The Crude Life, and we'll give it to the radio station here, Super Talk 1270, where this is also airing on. And then we're going to air it across our Crude Life affiliates. So we're going to have, like, you know, 20-some radio stations putting this on the weekend show and during the daily news updates and stuff like that. Where is the centralized? Do you have a centralized kind of location that you're sending people?
Yeah, I just sent them to GoFundMe. I think everybody knows how to use that. So go to GoFundMe and search Lindquist Ukraine, L-I-N-D-Q-U-I-S-T, Lindquist Ukraine, and you'll see my face pop up there. And really, as we talk about the power of social media, largely we've raised most of our $125,000 through social media and through my network of people that I know back home who knew that I was coming over here. And so never again say that one person can't make a difference. We've moved north of $1.7 million worth of medical supply into the hands of local Ukrainians because of social media. And with this latest shipment, it'll be up to $5 million. After spending 138 good days of work and, you know, trying to solve problems out here in war zone. And who better to solve problems in a war zone, Jason, but an American military veteran? Because if you're going to try to solve problems in a foreign country, of course you're going to send somebody with military experience. That's what we do. We solve problems in a foreign country. And so our team of veterans out here is here long term. And if you still care about the issue of Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, find us on GoFundMe.
Hey, I appreciate the time today and, you know, being frank and honest about things that are happening out there, even setting me straight a little bit on the pipeline issues. Of course, you and I come into our realizations about how important pipelines are, especially during emergency times and war times, yeah. But also the social media aspect, because when you take a look at remote workers and just the way that the iPhone and Motorola phones and smartphones work, boy, I tell you, most people are on their phones so much that I'd like you to kind of just, as we conclude here, talk about that embracement that the Ukrainian people have done about their passports and their wallet, because, boy, I felt like I was really hearing the future there, Mark, to be honest, when you were talking about the way the human beings in the Ukraine are using their phone now. That, to me, was kind of like the day-to-day version of what everybody tries to paint as fear-mongering out of China, because China, you know, tracks a lot of their citizens through their phones too, but they do it in totally different ways. The way you described over in the Ukraine seems a little bit more palatable and acceptable to the average person.
When I saw that from a local Ukrainian citizen in Kharkiv, and she showed me the app that's accessible on her and every citizen's smartphone, I literally said the words, "Oh my gosh, the United States is so far behind." Now, I believe the United States prides itself on being a leader in many ways. And in this specific instance, we are not even close to crossing the finish line at the same time as the Ukrainians. So lest you believe that Ukraine is a backwards country, that we are far superior to, they are way ahead of us with the citizens' embracing of this technology and its ability to do good in society. And I think we got to catch up, because I think one of the reasons why this country will win the war is because of technology and the use of it like that.
Once again, if you go to thecrudelife.com, you can get the links to Mark Lindquist's GoFundMe page, where they are doing all kinds of incredible things out there with medical supplies and just being humanitarians out there from America, a bunch of veterans out there from America doing some good out there. And my guess is you guys are being embraced wholeheartedly, huh? Because you've been out there for a while. They haven't kicked you out yet.
No, the Ukrainian people, I spent half my meetings with local Ukrainians receiving thanks, hugs, and tears based on the Western support that is poured in here. The HIMARS, the Javelins, the weapon systems are making it to the front lines. We are just pleading for more, because if we have more of that Western support, we will be able to push the Russians out of this country and hopefully get back to life post-war. But we can't do it alone. We need the help of the American public to create, during this election cycle, a priority that is Ukraine, because we believe this is the most important thing happening on planet Earth right now.
Well, I appreciate it, man. Hang on the line, but we got to say our goodbyes to the listeners out there. So anything you want to say in closing?
Just remember that the people over here are just like your neighbor, are just like your grandma, are just like your son or your daughter that has gone off to the military. And I've met them. I've talked to them through translators, and most of them speak good English. And I just want you to remember that these are human beings that have to worry about getting hit by a missile. There's human beings that are living in apartment complexes and are awakened by the sound of an artillery shell hitting their living room wall. And so it is individuals like myself who are over here in Ukraine, Western humanitarian volunteers who are doing interviews like this to try to remind the world that this is the most important thing on planet Earth right now.